is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington, and here is what's coming up on Africa News Tonight. West African leaders impose sanctions on the ruling Guinea's junta, and the U.S. threatens punitive actions against Ethiopia, Eritrea, and the TPLF. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. Faced with coups in Guinea and Mali and concerns that such unrest could spread, West African leaders decided yesterday to impose travel bans and freeze financial assets of the ruling juntas. The economic community of West African states has been criticized for not doing enough to promote stability and discourage coup. Jean-Claude Brault, president of the ECOWAS Commission, said after a summit that the penalties would be imposed on the individuals involved in the coup to send a clear signal that this is not acceptable. That includes the need to return to civilian rule quickly, with Brault said prompted ECOWAS leaders to include Mali in the sanctions.
And because there was a coup, and to give the clear signal that this is not acceptable, they impose sanction. They impose sanction on the member of the National Committee for Development and Restoration in Guinea, the new organ that has taken over. So sanction on those members. The sanction cover travel bans, freeze of asset, financial asset.
Brault said the members of the West African group were also concerned about reports of the possible deployment of Russian mercenaries in Mali.
There has been information that they will be signing between the authorities of Mali and a private security firm. So those are alleged information. There is no confirmation, but the head of state were very concerned. They condemned this very clearly and very firmly because they consider that this will have negative consequences in the security situation in Mali and in our region.
Brault said ECOWAS also will review its protocols, noting they are 20 years old. The United States threatened punitive action today against all parties to the widening conflict in northern Ethiopia in hopes of pressuring them to stop the deadly fighting and alleged abuses. A new executive order allows Washington to take punitive action against those in the Ethiopian and Eritrean governments, the Tigray People's Liberation Front, TPLF, and the Amhara Regional Government if they continue to pursue military conflict over negotiations. To avoid sanctions, leaders on both sides must agree to negotiations without preconditions and accept mediation under the former Nigerian President Olusegun Obasanjo, an African Union envoy who is scheduled to land in Ethiopia this weekend. President Joe Biden said he was appalled by the reports of mass murder, rape, and other sexual violence to terrorize civilian populations. Thousands have been killed and millions are in need of humanitarian assistance, the result of the fighting that erupted 10 months ago and the difficulties of providing aid to the 1.7 million people who have been left dependent on food aid. Today, Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed wrote an open letter to President Joe Biden to say that recent U.S. policy towards Ethiopia comes as a surprise given the two countries' decade of cooperation and security. He also said that Americans and the rest of the Western world are being misguided by reports that Abiy said portrayed victims as oppressors and oppressors as victims. Somalia has condemned what it calls the unlawful detention of the president's national security advisor at Djibouti airport. Fahad Yassin, who is the former head of the National Intelligence and Security Agency, is at the center of a power struggle between Somalia's president and prime minister. Mohammed Kayi reports from Mogadishu.
Somalia has condemned what it called Djibouti's illegal detention of President Mohamed Abdullahi Farmajo's national security advisor. Somali government spokesman Abdirashid Hashi, in a tweet Friday, said Thad Yassin was detained at Djibouti airport. Yassin was flying from Turkey to Mogadishu with a stop in Djibouti. Government spokesman Hashi tweeted, "Such acts will not help to strengthen ties between Somalia and Djibouti." Djibouti's Minister of Economy and Finance, Elias Dewale, tweeted a response to the communications director's accusation. Dewale asked him to refrain from any inappropriate and baseless statements. Djibouti's Foreign Minister Mohamed Youssef added, "They are fake news released in social media trying to create confusion and drag Djibouti into Somalia internal challenges and crisis." He added that, "We will continue to stand by our brothers and sisters in Somalia, but never interfere in their internal affairs." Yassin, who is the former head of Somalia's National Intelligence and Security Agency, is at the center of power struggle between Somalia's president and prime minister. Prime Minister Mohamed Hussein Roble suspended Yassin over the disappearance of a cybersecurity spy who the agency says was killed by militants group Al-Shabaab. Her family believes Somalia's spy agency was responsible for her disappearance. Yassin was due to attend a national security meeting on Saturday to discuss the controversial case. The case has Somalia's President Farmajo and the Prime Minister Roble in a standoff that threatens the country's elections and security gains. Farmajo on Thursday issued a suspension of Roble's executive powers, which the Prime Minister promptly rejected. Mohamed Kahiye for VOA News in Mogadishu, Somalia.
The President of the Security Council issued a statement yesterday in Ethiopia's massive hydroelectric dam project that is both straightforward and packed with diplomatic nuances. It says the Security Council encourages Egypt, Ethiopia, and the Sudan to resume negotiations at the invitation of the chairperson of the African Union to finalize expeditiously the text of mutually acceptable and binding agreement on the filling and operation of the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam within a reasonable time frame. Ahmed Fatih, a global affairs analyst and a UN correspondent, explained the careful wording to VOA senior analyst Mohammed Al-Shenawi.
For any document coming out of the Security Council, whether in the shape or form of a resolution or a statement, wording is everything. From this first item, I see two keywords that they have used. The first one is that it have to be legally binding agreement. So that means that the three countries have to commit to that. The second part is that it have to be concluded within a reasonable time frame. Those two items are in favor of what the Egyptian and the Sudanese were asking, because their main issue was the procrastination of the Ethiopian government while it was doing the secondary filling. Nature was merciful with them, and the rain came more than what was anticipated. So that concluded the second filling without any impact on the amount of water received by the downstream countries, Sudan and Egypt. So it is positive. The second point about wording, the Security Council clearly, with this presidential statement, is sending a clear and unambiguous message that the Security Council is not the place to settle technical disputes with water resources. It impacts many countries around the world, including the five permanent members of the Council. So you can imagine on an international and global level how sensitive are the issues of the water. The international community till today did not reach a conclusive formula to deal with the water resources issues. It remains within bilateral and regional domain till now. If it deteriorates further and it leads to a military action by any party to it, then it becomes a Security Council portfolio.
The UN Security Council statement also encouraged observers that have been invited to attend the African Union-led negotiations and any other observers that Egypt, Ethiopia, and the Sudan may decide to jointly invite to continue supporting the negotiations with a view to facilitating resolution of outstanding technical and legal issues. Would that lead to facilitating the troubled negotiations?
There were observers and mediators before. The United States, during the previous administration, took an active role in trying to mediate. However, to invite observers, each country can invite whoever they want to observe these talks. I believe that this is an invitation for countries like the United States to continue its mediation and observation level. On a different side, both Egypt and Ethiopia are going through literally a lobbying frenzy in Washington, D.C. Both of them hired new lobbying firms to explain their point of views. And on both sides, that means that they are going to be invested heavily in this dispute. Egypt, Sudan, downstream countries are in a very precarious situation. The other thing, the situation in Ethiopia, you know that we have a civil war, we have a humanitarian crisis exploding in Tigray. We have regional unrest in the Horn of Africa. This puts limitation on the amount of pressure that Egypt and the Sudan can exercise on Ethiopia. Ethiopia is in no hurry. There is a kind of a national consensus on the importance of the GERD project. And even if there is a change in government or a change in prime ministers, I don't think that the Ethiopian position will change. And that's going to be a very lengthy marathon of diplomatic battle.
The Security Council statement was careful to stipulate that this statement does not set out any principles or precedent in any other transboundary water disputes. Can you explain why?
The council is clear. They don't want to set any precedent. They didn't want to touch it. When we spoke about the water issues, is a major problem even inside the United States and among the other nations in the world. The council is clear. They do not want to touch this issue at all. Unless there is a deterioration in the situation and there is a military action, then it becomes the council priorities. In the meantime, regional organizations, mediation within a reasonable time frame. I think this was the key issue, that they put a reasonable time frame to avoid or to suppress attempts of procrastination.
That was Ahmed Fatih, a global affairs analyst and a UN correspondent, speaking with my colleague Mohammed Al-Shanawi. South Africa's Constitutional Court has dismissed former President Jacob Zuma's request that it rescind a contempt of court judgment and 15-month sentence for his refusal to appear before a commission of inquiry into corruption during his time in office. The ruling says Zuma failed to give compelling reasons why the court should let its own decision aside. Tusoko Malo reports from Johannesburg.
In his application to the Constitutional Court, Zuma argued that he was detained without trial since he did not get time to address the court. He wanted the court to set its decision aside to allow him to put up his defense. However, Justice Sisi Kampembe said the majority judgment noted that Zuma was given multiple opportunities to defend himself, but elected not to. She argued that Zuma failed to bring new facts that the court did not consider during the trial. He also failed to give good cause why he chose not to participate in the proceedings that led to his incarceration.
It is unfortunate, to say the very least, that Mr. Zuma failed to bring the submissions with which he now arms himself to the Constitutional Court before we reach this point. The hands of the Constitutional Court are bound, and Mr. Zuma himself bound them.
However, a minority judgment that was also read described Zuma's incarceration as unconstitutional and concurred with him that it was simply detention without trial. Kampembe said the majority judgment disagrees.
It must, of course, be emphasized that rescission is an avenue of legal recourse remains open, but only to those who advance meritorious and bona fide applications and who have not, at every turn of the page, sought to abuse judicial process.
The judgment has added another complication to Zuma's imprisonment saga. He has already been granted medical parole after serving 2 months of that sentence. Poja de la Cron, a legal expert, told the local media that, to some extent, the parole decision makes the judgment moot.
Mr. Zuma is no longer incarcerated at in Escort Prison. The argument, certainly, that many civil society organizations are now raising is that the decision that was taken by Mr. Fraser to place Mr. Zuma on medical parole was unlawfully taken. Ultimately, the effect of that decision, however, is that Mr. Zuma is no longer incarcerated.
Zuma's parole is already being challenged in court, and those challenging it hope Zuma will be sent back to prison. But Thabo Mosweni from Democracy in Action, an organization standing firmly behind Zuma, told reporters that the fight for the former president's freedom is not over yet.
We are going to take the matter outside the country to the African Human and People's Rights Commission, because we really do feel as an organization that our human rights were not protected in this particular matter, especially those of the former president.
Zuma is still hospitalized following a surgical procedure for an undisclosed illness. His condition is unknown as he has not been seen in public. Tuso Kumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
You're listening to African News Tonight. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. Here's a recap of our top stories. West African leaders impose sanctions on the ruling Guinea's junta. And the U.S. threatens punitive actions against Ethiopia, Eritrea, and the TPLF. Thanks for listening to VOA Africa. And for more news and information, visit our website at voanews.com. Two men have been accused of defamation after they allegedly lied to a Burkina Faso journalist in a recent report, which found that those responsible for distributing aid in the country are exploiting internally displaced women demanding sex in return for food. The government and the media outlet which published the story are now at loggerheads as the trial of the two men is set for the end of the month. Henry Wickens reports from Kongoussi.
In the northern town of Kongoussi on Wednesday, two men displaced by Burkina Faso's conflict stood accused of defamation after they told a local journalist the women in their community, including one of their wives, had been forced into sex in exchange for food aid distributed by the government. A key witness, the director of Minute BF, who initially published the story, did not arrive for the court hearing. The judge subsequently postponed the case until the 29th of September. Minute BF published a statement on their website later in the day, claiming they had not received a summons to appear at the court. Speaking to VOA Wednesday, Lasane Sawadogo, director of Minute BF, said he believes they spoke to credible witnesses despite doubts after publication.
Une de notre source a clairement dit que sa femme a échangé son sexe contre la nourriture.
One of the sources clearly said that his wife traded sex for food. For us, a husband who makes such statements about his own wife cannot be lying. But how do we verify such information? We've now been told that the people we interviewed confessed they lied. What's to say they're not lying again? He went on to say he hopes the government will investigate the allegations of sex in exchange for food in other parts of the country too. Last month, VOA and another news website focusing on humanitarian stories, The New Humanitarian, also published stories documenting testimonies from 9 women who said they'd been forced into sex in exchange for food aid in the nearby city of Kaya. One of the defendants outside the courtroom in Kongoussi told VOA he had lied to Minute BF. Meanwhile, members of the government's social action department responsible for distributing aid in the area spoke to members of the local press. When VOA asked for an interview, they said they were banned from speaking to international media without authorization. At a press conference on Monday, the Minister for Humanitarian Affairs, Lawrence Ilbudo Marshall, blamed MinuteBF for rushing to publish without verification in response to a question on the matter. MinuteBF, what you did here, you almost destroyed families because you didn't give us time to answer you, she said. You were making an important denunciation. Did you write to us, let us listen to you, or come to ask us and say, Madam Minister, here are the accusations, what is your answer? If you had published our response, maybe this wouldn't have gone to court, she said. At the press conference, the minister also faced questions about a recent report from aid group, the Norwegian Refugee Council, which said the government was slow to register newly displaced people and was risking lives as a result. Over the last year, the government has also implemented a ban on journalists trying to visit official camps for internally displaced people in the country. With neither the government nor MinuteBF seeming ready to back down, Burkina Faso's Sex for Food aid scandal remains unsolved. Henry Wilkins for VOA News, Kongusi, Burkina Faso.
Botswana's president, Mokgweetsi Masisi, says his country will defend its territorial integrity amid growing attacks from Zimbabwean cattle rustlers along the two countries' common border. Masisi says he will engage his Zimbabwean counterpart, President Emmerson Mnangagwa, as more than 2,000 cattle have been reported stolen in the last 2 years. From Habrone, Botswana, reporter Mokandisi Dube has the details.
Masisi says the time has come to put an end to often deadly cross-border cattle rustling activities. Farmers in northeastern Botswana live in fear as cattle rustlers from Zimbabwe cross over to steal their beasts. Some residents have been forced to abandon their homes out of fear of the axe-wielding syndicates. Masisi heard from the villagers this week. Some, like Chief Esa Madema, want brutal measures like a shoot-to-kill strategy to stem the cattle rustling tide.
Our livestock is stolen and driven to Zimbabwe every day. The closure of borders because of COVID-19 means we are unable to track our animals. We have formed groups to fight these criminals, but we are unarmed.
Masisi says the country will not adopt a shoot-to-kill strategy, but promised his government will act.
Cattle rustling is caused by a security problem. Our people are now refugees in their own country. You cannot run a country where the natives are displaced by thugs.
I don't accept it, and I will never accept it. Law and order must prevail and will prevail.
Masisi says he will engage his Zimbabwean counterpart over the issue.
It is an issue that I will take up with President Mnangagwa, but before that I will ask my Minister of Foreign Affairs to talk to Zimbabwe's ambassador to Botswana. I want the ambassador to come here and see the situation for himself and report to his superiors in Zimbabwe.
The Zimbabwe embassy in Gaborone says it will wait for official communication from the Botswana government. Masisi says in the meantime he will form a task force to tackle the problem as well as beef up security along the border. Botswana and Zimbabwe share an 850-kilometer border. For VOA, this is Mqondisi Dube in Gaborone, Botswana.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehius Wahib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.
Straight Talk Africa. As countries worldwide work to get shots in arms, many are running into a problem of trust and vaccine hesitancy. Is fake news behind it? And is misinformation on social media hurting vaccination drives across Africa? Join me, Heidi Adams, on the next Straight Talk Africa this Wednesday at 18:30 UTC.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel. Next up, the pros and cons of expanding the U.S. Supreme Court. Nine justices currently sit on the High Court, but after former President Donald Trump solidified the court's conservative majority with three appointees, some Democrats are urging the Biden administration to add seats. The pros and cons of expanding the Supreme Court, that's in Counter. This